What's up, Vital listeners? We are currently in Scotts Valley, California, at the Fox Factory headquarters, checking out their model year 2025 suspension products. And we are here with Bill Brown, who is the head of engineering at Fox, to run us through the overarching goals and changes of the latest product line. Bill, thank you for chatting with us today.
Absolutely.
Let's start from 10,000 feet above and just go through what's changed and what you guys were looking to improve from the existing products. And maybe say focusing more on dampers and kind of starting there.
Yeah, that'll be easy because dampers were our main focus. Pretty much every fork is getting a new damper for model year 25. Cross country, Grip SL, trail bikes with Grip X, and gravity bikes with Grip X2. And the learnings that we've put into those dampers, we've also trickled into our Grip for like Rhythm Performance Series forks, and the rail damper that is found in a lot of the Marzocchi products. So across the board, all of our forks are receiving either a new damper or a nice upgrade in the performance of an existing damper.
With those three new Grip dampers, can you just run us through kind of the details of each and how they've been optimized for their respective riding disciplines and chassis?
Sure. The goal with those three new dampers, not only to bring additional damping support and control to the front end of a bike, but do so in a way that doesn't add or actually even reduces the harshness of the fork. And doesn't sacrifice the sensitivity of it. Each damper, though, is kind of tailored towards the discipline it's meant to support. So on like the Grip SL damper, balancing its performance with also the requirement for it to be really lightweight, because that's super important to the cross-country crowd. That fork's got to be light. The damper's a big part of the weight of the fork. So trying to make a damper that's really light but also performs really well was a driving objective for that Grip SL damper. Because of that, it looks really different than the other dampers. It's got a smaller pressure tube. It's got an 8mm shaft, but it uses the same compression piston, the same base piston as Grip X and Grip X2. And it's also based on spring-backed IFP, so it's no longer a bladder like Fit 4 was. Grip X2, pure gravity performance. We didn't set out to build a heavy damper, but weight wasn't really a driving, motivating factor for the design of that damper. It was ultimate descending performance and adjustability. So it maintains high and low speed compression, maintains high and low speed rebound adjustment. But on compression, it's accomplishing it in a different way than what Grip 2 did. The Grip X2 damper does away with the variable valve control and compression. We keep it on high-speed rebound because it's really effective on that circuit. But we replace it on compression, on high-speed compression, with a more traditional shim stack and preload spring. And it's a base valve design that we adopted from our Power Sports division. They use it on a lot of their off-road race vehicles. The other thing that's new in the Grip X2 damper is how we're dividing damping on compression between the base valve and the mid valve. We're actually achieving more compression damping at the mid valve than we were doing with Grip 2. And that's helped us on the response time of that damper. And it's the response time of that damper that helps with the additional support without the harshness. The faster a damper can respond, the more damping it can produce without it feeling harsh. And that was a main focus on all three of the dampers, and we took it to a very extreme with Grip X2. Grip X sits in the middle because trail bikes kind of sit in the middle, right? You want a bike that you can, at least for me, that I can pedal for 4 hours. It's kind of my limit. And still confidently descend on trails that sometimes I would be riding a longer travel bike on. But, you know, I need that lightweight, like a lot of riders do. I need that bike to be as light as possible because I want to go for a really long ride. So Grip X kind of strikes that balance between weight and performance. We don't really sacrifice performance compared to Grip X2 with Grip X, but we take some weight out of it and do so by removing some adjustability.
You want to run us through just which fork chassis have which dampers and how you guys have kind of decided, you know, between 32, 34, 36, 38, 40, which dampers kind of end up in each? I know it's more obvious on each end, but what happens with like 34 and 36?
Yeah, the middle kind of blurs a little bit. And that's somewhat intentional because those, you know, that 34 and the 36, you can build varying bikes with those forks. Like I've got two bikes. One's a 160 travel bike and one's a 130, 140. They both got 36s on them. But that's, I mean, that's just me. Someone might put a 34 on that 140 travel bike and try to make it even lighter. So we, on a 34 and a 36, you can get a Grip X or a Grip X2, whatever your preference is. It's not up to us to say how your bike should ride. We want to be able to support your vision for the bike that you want to build and how you want to ride.
Got you. So if you have the choice between Grip X and Grip X2, I think a lot of riders might see that you have a little bit more adjustability with the X2 and just assume it's more high performance, it's better, it's the premium product. But it sounds like a lot of that comes down to them observing what type of riding they're doing. Weight's also probably one of the leading factors in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. What's going to happen with Grip 2 and Fit 4? Does it continue to live on in any products?
No, those two dampers are going to no longer continue in production.
Okay.
We'll continue to support them in the field. Like all of our Fox product, it's serviceable for, I don't think actually we've ever stopped servicing anything. We get some really old suspension back sometimes and still find a way to service it with parts. So we'll continue to service those products, but they're no longer going to be produced by our factory.
Cool. I think I'm getting through most of my pretty broad ones. Do you want to hop on with some more detailed questions?
Yeah.
Sweet.
You already mentioned that, yeah, people might be like, oh, Grip X doesn't offer all the same kind of performance benefits. How did you guys kind of come up with that high-speed rebound? I know you guys mentioned you looked at kind of what a lot of people would settle into as far as like the range, I think, mm-hmm. to set it. How do you find that works with like the minimum and maximum pressure ranges? Is that something that may require some additional tuning, or do you find it seems to work up to that maximum pressure range just fine?
I think it works well up to that maximum pressure range, and it works well down at that like kind of minimum pressure range. That doesn't mean that there won't be, a handful of riders that rebounds closed, they're at max pressure, rebounds closed, and maybe for their personal preference, they wish it was a little slower, right? Rebound can be a bit of a personal preference setting for a lot of people. Some like it a little bit faster than, to run the rebound a little bit faster than others. So as you get towards that maximum pressure rating, I wouldn't be surprised if you're running a rebound closed at that point.
That's what all clicks are for, right?
That's
a full range.
We wanted to have a full usable range. I think Ariel mentioned it yesterday. We've had dampers in the past, and there's definitely dampers out there where you can go from shit to shit. And what's the point of having those clicks? Because you're never going to use them. So we wanted to have a usable range on all of our adjusters, including rebound.
Right on. And yeah, you guys also mentioned the goal of increasing sensitivity and support, simultaneously controlling the pressure within the damper. Has the internal pressure changed among all the dampers? Like, have you gone up in pressure to create that kind of like?
We've tried to go as low as possible in pressure, actually. The lower, there's two pressures when talking about dampers. There's kind of the static IFP pressure, but then there's the dynamic pressure, right? When the damper's moving, it's creating actually some pretty high pressures. We've tried to keep that dynamic pressure as low as possible, because the lower that pressure is, the faster the damper can respond.
And has that increased from 20 millimeter to a 24 millimeter base valve? Is that, you said that's across all grip dampers?
Yes. Grip SL, Grip X, Grip X2.
Okay. Does that base valve increasing in size, does that just increase the diameter of like the tube it's in to kind of lower the pressure, or how does that play into that? The larger base valve.
We went to a larger base piston so that we could use larger diameter valve. So if you, when you look at a valve, it's just a round washer, right? A super thin washer. But if you were to, you know, look at a cross section, you could think of the valve as like a beam, right? That beam is flexing. So the longer you make that beam, softer it is, right? So you can stack more of them up and give you more control over how that beam bends. The larger diameter piston allowed us to use larger diameter valves, which gave us more control over the stiffness of that valve stack. And having more control over the stiffness of that valve stack gave us more control over the entire pressure range, dynamic pressure range happening inside of that damper.
Right on that. Seems like going from the, what was it, 7 valves up to 23? That kind of creates a more consistent ramp, do you find, or like flex across all those valves? Like you have a bigger one at the bottom, and I saw there's some breaks in between kind of to smooth that out.
Yeah, and so what we're trying to do there is really control the transition from your low-speed compression to your high-speed compression. And typically when you look at, when you characterize a damper, you're doing it on a dyno, you're looking at a force versus velocity graph. That's a typical graph you might look at on a dyno. And you can generate lots of different curve shapes out of a damper on that type of a chart. The one that's hardest to create and the one that we're trying to create is a straight diagonal line.
As linear as possible.
Yep. And the reason why it's so hard to do that is pressure inside of a damper as oil's flowing through an orifice or as it's flowing through ports out the valves, it doesn't want to behave linearly with velocity. Mm-hmm. It wants to behave exponentially. So that's what the valves are trying to do. They're trying to take an exponential behavior and they're trying to flatten it out and make it linear.
Makes sense. Having a larger stack, you can kind of taper it off rather than hit a wall.
That's right. So that, when Sergio was talking about, you know, Sergio is telling us in engineering, I need something more tunable. Mm-hmm. And what he's asking for is more control over that valve stack because he and his team were trying to get something that was very linear. And
remove the shit from the equation, as you said, at both ends.
pretty much. And the best way to do that is to have as much control as possible over the stiffness of that valve stack. And its stiffness changes as it opens. That's why you saw like the breaks in it. Mm-hmm. And kind of the pyramid shape of it.
Yeah, it's giving you a bigger like area to spread over.
Every single one of those valves was intentional. Like there was nothing in there that's like, oh well, let's just put a couple more in.
Yeah, right.
Just every single one of those valves was intentional.
That's really cool. And to see the breaks, as soon as I saw that, I was like, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you do that to begin with? But they kind of breezed over it. But I feel like it's pretty significant. You guys mentioned these forks have all new bushings. Is that more related to bushing overlap, or is it different material altogether? And what sort of goals do those new bushings achieve?
The upper bushings in our forks haven't changed. Those are the same. It's the lower bushings. The lower bushings used to have grooves cut into the bushing liner to promote oil movement inside of the fork. With the channels that we have in our lower legs, those channels are serving that purpose. Getting rid of those grooves allowed us to maintain more of an oil film thickness around the full circumference of the stanchion to reduce friction a little bit.
That makes sense. There's not just some random break in it.
That's right. Yeah, you can think of like car tires, right? The tread is there to cut water and evacuate it from the interface between the tire and the road, right? You don't want to evacuate the oil from that interface. You want to keep the oil in the interface. So we got rid of those grooves.
Did you guys notice significant like increase in or reduction in friction from that?
Reduction in friction and also more consistent performance over time.
Is that backwards compatible?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so if you were to send your fork in for service and have the bushings replaced, they'd probably get replaced with these new grooveless lower bushings.
Yep. We just got done chatting with Bill about just more
architecture,
just the product line and dampers and all that. And now we're stoked to bug you about X2 and get into all that. So All right, we're joined now by Sergio Avanto, who is the manager of product performance here at Fox, and he is one of the main minds behind the new Grip X2 damper. Thanks for joining us, Sergio.
Absolutely.
Let's, you know, we're coming off quite a few years of success with the Grip 2 damper that most riders are very familiar with. When you guys took on developing a new damper that would build on where Grip 2 was, what were the main goals and what were you looking to improve on?
I think the first thing we found was with Grip 2, I call it, just because I started 3 years ago, my third year here, it was really didn't have a platform that it could accept the kind of valving that we would need to introduce to get the damping levels where we needed. Albeit we did some changes to it, immediately some of the restrictions that exist, and one of those was just the VVC configuration, that took more room than the room allowed to valve. We ran smack dab into that. And so we needed to create more room, essentially, and that information was fed up the chain, and that drove the change in diameter, which ultimately gave us the room. So it was really, I think that the basic architecture is just like a motorcycle fork. Like all the top level forks essentially have the spring backed IFP, same setup. But those are tunable and they have a lot more room, let's say, where the education for me going from those to here was everything is really, really super pinner, really, really small. And it's really creating that room to do the work that we need to do was the first indication of what needed to improve. From that, we looked at some fundamental changes that they were introducing in engineering, and we just made sure that as they were iterating through design, we kept going in the field with it and proving that it was pushing in the right direction, because it's quite easy to change the design for the engineers in a way that they may not register the deficiency that's been introduced because they're not necessarily the ones that are doing the field testing. And albeit a dyno is wonderful, we're having this conversation right now, it's kind of funny, it doesn't tell you the whole story. Two dampers that are line on line, that means that they're basically developing the same damping forces on the machine, can feel very, very different. And that's one of the things that we found is that because we matched the damping forces between Grip 2 and Grip X2 as close as we possibly could, and it was already feeling better. And once we crossed that threshold, the engineering team started locking in the designs around it as we continued to iterate and improve performance.
That's pretty cool.
It's interesting because when I landed, the fork was the opportunity. I knew it from a while ago. I've ridden mountain bikes, and my position of it was I always feel more comfortable on my motorcycle. I get on a bicycle, look at some downhill, then I get on a motorcycle, and all of a sudden I can go quadruple as difficult, and why is that? And I just saw that mountain biking in general just depended too much on the air spring and didn't really bring the damping into bear, right? And a lot of the thinking was that damping equals harshness, and I think that that is ingrained everywhere in the industry. And one of my concerns is how is the industry going to absorb dampers that are truly balancing that load out? And that was very quickly, my concerns were washed away because the performance and gain was just so significant. Yeah. That I think that we would say somebody just needs to ride it and then they're going to realize what the benefit is.
Mm-hmm. For somebody who's ridden Grip 2, they get on X2 damper, and that difference from the thinking of relying more on air versus damping, what maybe feel differences are they going to encounter on trail, and maybe how might that dictate how they set up the X2 versus Grip 2?
So one of the first things that we found, and we're debating whether or not to, this is in engineering's realm, right? They defined the information that goes to the public. We just sort of advise on that. But we found that as we started increasing the damping forces in the fork, you weren't so dependent on your air spring. And one of the things that is just kind of ingrained in my mind is when you take an air spring and you add a volume reducer, forever when you touch that displacement, you're always going to have that force. And you may not always need it, right? And so if you don't want to bottom out and you put a bunch of volume reducers, volume spacers, whatever people want to call them, that air spring ramps up and it's permanent. And what my thing is once it's in there, you really need to hit a big hit to utilize all your stroke. My position from racing is to get the best performance, you kind of do need to use all of your stroke. And if you can use it all and not have the air spring build up so much, then you're going to have better performance. And so that's what happened. As we added more compression control, less dependent on the air spring. So it's pretty typical for a drop between 5 and 10 PSI, maybe a volume token taken out, and people to experiment with that. So if they have a bottoming issue or they think it's too soft, turn in the compression first. And then once you have that compression in, adjust your rebound, right? And then what you're left with is what remnants are in your air spring. So if you're still bottoming and you've done that, okay, then put in a token. But don't block off all of that good performance by going to that. That's really the fundamental change between the two, I think, that they'll experience the most.
That's pretty big. It's quite a philosophy difference from, I think, a lot of people's experience with Fox products the last couple of years, at least, with Grip 2.
So, yeah, the big topic's been, like, a wider usable range of adjustment than on Grip 2. Everyone kind of has their preferences on setup where they may prefer that higher air pressure. Is your guys' goal then pretty much to kind of get people further into the range and back away from...
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's what you just answered.
Yeah,
but mentioning, like, oh, soften up a bit, maybe go further into compression, then set your rebound. Are you referring, like, maybe try playing with high-speed rebound now that you're getting further in, like... experience that end of the travel rebounding differently where you would maybe leave low speed alone?
I would say that, because a lot of times, shifting gears a little bit in this conversation to the rear end, one of the things I found in mountain bike industry is everybody likes to solve kicking with adding rebound. And that's, there's a huge penalty when you add rebound, right? You're holding the wheel in place and you really start hurting traction. And my experience showed me that most of the people we work with aren't on a clock, so they don't realize that they're paying this price. So rebound is really, really detrimental if you have too much of it. And the key to solving kicking is compression control. Because kicking, and this, it's funny, we call them fence line solutions, right? The fans at the Supercross and the Motocross races come and ask us questions, how do I solve kicking? Everyone says rebound. And that's the last thing we touch, right? Rebound, or kicking, usually is built from excessive use of the compression stroke, and then it ejects. So you're providing a solution after the event has happened, right? And on the front end, you have a similar condition, but even worse, because if you break traction on your front end, you're going to crash. And so we like to set rebound and not necessarily hold it, but it isn't a fixer of a lot of the problems that's generally understood in the mountain bike industry. And so you want to be very careful with it. But compression, on the other hand, when you start adding it, just like opposite of a spring, is when you add more compression, typically you can run your more freer rebound. And that's really the goal. So you're limiting the compression stroke, but allowing it to open kind of quickly so it doesn't get out of control. That will get you down the hill faster than just cranking in rebound.
Right, like control the energy that's storing rather than slowing what's already stored, like keep it from getting there and storing a ton.
Exactly. Anytime you see, if you watch the Nationals or even Supercross, you see this, they're running a soft setup, and you'll see it when it gets really, really gnarly and the whoops get kind of crazy, you'll start seeing that effect amplify. And on a Supercross track, if you were to increase rebound to fix that, you're talking 2 seconds, 2.5 seconds, and it shows up like that, right? That's where we learn that. But then I was wondering why mountain biking didn't learn that lesson. Oh, they're not on the clock, so they don't know they're paying a price. And as soon as we put people on the clock, it shows up plain as day.
Yeah, I guess on the fork end, do you feel like, you know, dropping that pressure could create not a kicking feeling, but maybe a diving feeling? Is that where you would say, rather than looking at air pressure, look at now like low speed compression, and on those successive hits, don't look at volume spacers, look at our high speed compression and control the velocity rather than change the whole spring curve?
Exactly. Yeah, like use the spring curve, not as last resort necessarily. They're all sort of equally valuable, right? You want to play with all of them, but try that first. And I think that in the end, you'll find a better solution.
Yeah, I mean, you guys also mentioned it, kind of the damping curve now or in the past and still can go way past what most people will even utilize. Is that more relative to just expanding like valve tunability from having more shims to play with, or does it create more support through the range of adjustment, like naturally? I'm trying to think of how
Getting the question.
I think I typed that, didn't read it out loud.
It was a late night question.
Yeah. So going past what most people utilize, is that a result of like having more valve tunability? Like, were you guys be able to create a lot more support out of the stack itself, I guess? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what we've done is, and this is actually something that no one's talked about, is historically on a So when we're talking about a mid-valve, just to be clear, it's the main compression piston on the damping rod, just like a shock absorber.
That's what's introduced into the oil, like when you compress it?
Yeah, okay. We don't have any pictures. But if you look at a shock, there's a damping rod, just a fork cylinder, right? The cylinder parts up here and the rod's down here. On the end of this rod is a piston, and that piston goes through the oil. That's the main piston, shock and fork. To me, they're no different. And so historically, what you do on a fork is you make that compression circuit on the main valve just a flapper valve. Why? Because the speeds are so incredibly high, if you really valve it up heavy, it'll break over time, right? That's what we do in racing, and that's the ultimate in performance. We load that valve up incredibly heavy, supercross especially, but I change it every few hours, right? That's what I can do, but I knew that the performance is sitting there. What we found here is sort of a happy medium between we can load that thing up in a way to contribute, but not so much where those valves are subject to excessive wear and failure. So if you look at KYB, Showa, and WP, KYB came up with a different style of mid-valve to tighten that up in production, and that's what they're making now. Showa has followed suit. WP created what's called a cone valve to do it. So the problem exists in every discipline of two wheels. Coming here, it is something that we had to figure out because it is an engineering puzzle. How do you get that level of control in a fork that pros get and make it manufacturable for the masses? And I told the man sitting here, Bill's a fantastic boss, that there's a significant challenge here. I can make the thing rip, but can we manufacture it at scale? And they took it and did wonders with it, and they're spitting them out, and it's working. So for me, it's really rad because that is a challenge, right? And they figured it out, and I'm reminded that's the strength of Fox, the manufacturing monster. And I saw that machine moving for the first time in my career because it's blocked out with the Japanese, right? Here I got to see it, and it's impressive be able to take that and pull it off, yeah.
I guess the last manufacturing thing, they mentioned those hats that kind of load that valve, and they mentioned the ability to kind of change the diameter of those. Does that just create, like, a more solid foundation for the base valve, or does it go to, like, does it sit on different valves as it changes
in size? It sits on different valves. So if you want more range of adjustability, you go wider and wider. But there's a limit because you don't want to go to the face shims, the first ones.
Yeah, you don't want to, like, tuck everything into that hat. You want to be...
Exactly. You want to have some free and then holding some.
So the smaller would restrict the flow.
Yeah.
And the bigger, yeah, makes sense.
Just to come back to Herbie.
No, we're gonna go somewhere else. All right, that was a lot of fun fork talk about bikes, but I'm a fan of Supercross and all of that, and I know that you have such an extensive background in that. Who have you worked with recently that's super difficult or really particular, or like maybe like what's some cool insights of just suspension setup at Supercross? As a fan, all you ever hear about is just like it's super stiff, a normal human can never hold on and ride it, but like why and what are they chasing and what are they so focused on?
They do such a bad job, I think, of selling the story internally. There are so many insane stories that I forget, right? There's so many of them, and the public never knows. And Mathis actually tried to bring that to bear so everybody sort of saw the inside, like Formula One did with their Netflix show or whatever. I would have to say the most challenging recently was Aaron Plessinger when I was with Yamaha. I had AP and Justin Barsha, and I love AP, he's wonderful. But he grew up on air forks, and air forks and moto have this just frustrating response post-apex. Apex is the center of the corner. So you go into a supercross turn, and they bottom out in the corner. That's how fast they're going in and aggressive. So they're using most of their stroke. But then the air fork would just go to full extension at apex, and then he's managing this front end that's tall. I'm sure you know the feeling, like a sinking rear end. You don't have a lot of control. And that moment there was just very difficult to fix for him, and we didn't get it for him. And we had RV, Ryan Villapoto, come out and do some work for us, and he set up a great motocross fork. That's the one we raced. I think it was 2020. He actually set up the whole bike that year for us. But we put AP on it. He was faster. He was less tired. And he just didn't have the confidence to go racing with it. And it was such a puzzle in my head. Like, why? And he has his reasons, right? Like, he's going to risk his life on this machine. And his thing was, because he's a big guy, he just does this. And then he can, because we went from air to coil. And coil was the thing that he rode that was, he was better, he was faster. But then he said when he would put his weight forward, it would just sink in and the air fork would just stay extended, so he felt comfortable moving his upper body more just because he's big. Yeah. Obviously, K KTM figured out something for him. It was kudos. I'm happy to see him kind of up on the thing. But he was complicated, but it wasn't an ugly complicated. It was more like I'm frustrated that I can't give him what he needs because I know he's deficient. Barcia was easier to come around, and we had a great motocross season with him. AP, when we did finally get a setting that he was hauling ass on, we were at Paula, and he crashed, and he missed the whole motocross season. So it was really a bummer. We kind of have a breakthrough with him,
yeah.
And that's the thing of racing is just you never know. Months of work have fallen down in the first turn in Anaheim 1 before, and it's the feeling is really difficult to describe. But I have to put if I had to put my finger on the single most difficult rider I've ever worked with, Ken Roczen, by a mile. Like, easily, he's standalone. It used to be David Villeman, right, because he's challenging too, number 934. But Roczen, he came to us, because it was Ricky Carmichael, Kerry Hart that ran RCH, and they wanted to win a championship. And so they went after him with big money. And I remember talking to the KTM guys, like, everybody knows everybody. And they were sharing with us what the issues were with him. And Ken was so vocal about the deficiencies of KTM that I thought, I don't think that KTM is necessarily the problem here. There were some signs early on, right? And then he came on board and KTM'd us, went to Honda, KTM'd Honda. And now he's with Suzuki and Larry Brooks and he's doing good, you know, good for him kind of thing. But what made him difficult is that the way to approach testing is especially for Supercross, there's just so many variables, like hundreds of variables. I mean, things that mountain bike hasn't even considered yet were changing. And my role is basically from the front tire contact patch through the wheels, through the engine, through the ECU, back to the rear tire shock. I controlled the whole vehicle, right? I oversaw all that stuff. And in order to get through that, you need to have really a structured way so that you test it. And when you test it, you know you don't have to test it again because you've answered all the questions. And so tried to do that with him. Tried to organize a test, whatever his problem is. We'd build multiple samples to try and fix what he wanted. And then he would show up and do his warm-up lap and go over here. He wants to try transmissions today, and we're ready to set up suspension. We're ready to do engine, and he wants to do tire testing. And it was just like, and I so wanted to sit down with him and just, I mean, I don't know, and I always tell this to him, I don't know how to do what you do, but I know how to get race teams to give you exactly what you want. Yeah. And it never, ever happened until the day that he won the championship, right? Because how we won the championship is we went to Suzuki, argued to get off of Showa and go to KYB. And to be quite honest, they're very, very similar, but there are little nuances between them. We convinced the president of Suzuki in this massive meeting. It's no joke, right? It is huge.
Yeah.
The president of Suzuki sitting there. It's this giant conference room. It looks like the UN. And everyone is wrestling about this. And Ricky Carmichael steps up, and he wrote them both. And he said, absolutely, if you want to win a championship, this is our best move. At that point, my feeling was, because you can never underestimate the value of giving a rider what he wants, right? And it definitely...
Oh, hold on. Sorry. Did we run too long? Oh, I think we're getting really hot.
More interesting.
You just want to swap this mic and we'll keep recording on that?
Yeah.
I'll just take yours and you can
continue, I guess, where you...
It was crazy.
Any of those corporations, you're in a room of like a million people making decisions. Like, can't imagine they going to Yamaha and having that discussion. They're probably even bigger, but they at least are like, oh, whatever you want. We just want to win. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah. That really is the mentality that you need to have, and that's really what I insist on the people that are on the product performance team. Is that I don't care what you need, it's what the customer needs. And that's really the recipe for success, is no matter how crazy, and Keith McCarty always uses the example of gold handlebars. They want gold handlebars, we're putting gold handlebars in the bike.
Yeah.
So we convinced Suzuki that that's an okay thing because it's impacting sales and the visibility and all that kind of stuff. We put them on KYB stuff. And he's golden. He's happy. We did what he wanted. And I think he flexed, you know. That's what I think happened. But not to take anything away from KYB. They're fantastic. They do great work. He won the motocross championship that year.
Was it difficult to, like, set up the bike once he had that? It was more just the scheduling thing of, like, can we have an agenda? And you're just, like, shuffling it every day?
As soon as we put him on KYB, we didn't touch it all season.
But, like, wow. Yeah, well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And we know what those settings are. We have them on the dyno. They're not too different from what he had. So the open-ended question is, how truly different is it? And he's really the only one that can tell. But the fact of the matter is, we moved. This is what I liked about RCH. Whatever we got to do, we did. We moved mountains and got it and squeezed the championship out of them. But we're at Bud's Creek celebrating the championship. Everyone's drunk. I was driving, so I was sober. So I remember this clear as day. And the entire tuning team is in the lounge just celebrating. We won, right? And he walks in, and he's super friendly and high-fiving everybody. And he sits down, and he talks about the dirt bike the way we asked him to from day one. That was the only time we actually got to talk to him in a way that was constructive. He was talking to the engine guy. He was talking to the EFI guy. He was talking to me. He was talking to the suspension guy. And all of us just had this encyclopedia of work. And then he went to Honda and got his ass handed to him, right? And I remember Kyle Bentley saying, "You're going to Honda. That's the place people's careers go to die." And the crazy thing about Honda, nothing against them. I think the thing that happened at Honda is they have more variables than anybody else in the industry. It was so impressive to see how they run their race program. It is unprecedented. But there's a problem with too many variables. If you can change the spoke on your wheels, its rigidity, and you have four options, right? And that's just the spokes. You can imagine once you spread that out over the entire vehicle, and you basically have from September till, I'd say, close to the end of November to lock a bike down before they get ready.
Or less,
now with the super motocross thing.
Yeah, that's insane.
And I think they just got caught out in that. But Lars, who's leading it now, credit to him, he saw this whole thing happening while he was coming up. Mm-hmm. And I think he's put things in place that actually have worked. And I think Jet is really the example of it. But Ken did that same thing. If you run in the circles, you see the Showa guy at Honda, another Showa guy at Honda, another. And that's what we were experiencing was he has a hard time trusting the people that really have his best interests in mind. And there was nothing I could do to convince him. Please talk to us and let us know. He fought us, and he fought us in the public forum. And I think if I had to put my finger on one thing that made us the most upset was we're trying to talk him off the cliff of a setting. We're trying to tell him that it's not going to work, whatever. It doesn't. He flounders and then goes in the public and points fingers at RCH. And that was really, I don't know, at that moment I was just sort of, I don't want to say given up, but it was getting so bad that I think it was time for him to find another group. And ultimately he saw RCH as a podunk team, even though that he won a championship on. And Honda, all riders see Honda as the pinnacle, right?
Yeah.
And he wanted to go experience that. And then you shortly after that, the arm,
yeah,
those
another arm.
Those pitchers, you know, yeah. And then he did it again by sticking his thing in Cooper Webb's wheel.
He eventually won a championship on that bike.
Yep.
It was, what, the year after or 2 years after?
I forget, but it was a little bit after that.
But, yeah, certainly wasn't testing during that time.
And very different than Jeremy McGrath, James Stewart, like all those people I was able to talk to and give them what they were looking for. But Ken is quite honestly the anomaly. And I feel better because the KTM guy struggled with it. We struggled with it. Honda struggled with it. The guy that I work with at Yamaha, who I helped learn, teach suspension, he's the crew chief for Jet now. So he runs that program. And that's how I know kind of how things went down. Not from him necessarily, just from the outside and the shifts and the things that he said publicly. They echo what he said when he was on RCH. And the thing that's crazy for me is he goes full circle, ends up on a Suzuki, and he's winning again. And that's exactly what Kyle Bentley, the manager, warned him of.
Yeah.
But you know what it's like to be young, right? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
You can do what you want. Nobody knows anything.
Yeah, you got to show up to a press conference at an NSX. Good timing on that.
Right? Yeah.
They're like, we'll see you back here eventually.
Yeah. That's what I like about Jet, actually. He pulls up to the race in a Ferrari, or no, a Porsche, I think it was, some blue one. And the last two guys I remember being that rad are McGrath and Button when they were at the top. I think Button had a Mercedes. I forget what McGrath had, but they're parked by the truck, and he's got shiny stuff all over, just like a full-on show, you know?
Yeah.
I think Judd's bringing that back. It's kind of cool.
That's cool. As a kid, you're like, I want to do that. I want to be that guy. Not like, oh, I got my Honda Ridgeline.
No, totally. Yeah, totally.
What a... Have you worked with Jet ever?
No.
Okay.
No.
If watching somebody like him in the sport where they talk so much about his body positioning on a bike and he's like changing the way riders ride a motorcycle, do you see his like working differently, kind of in unison with him? Or is there anything that stands out with the way he rides?
There's something when I was at Yamaha during the COVID year. I remember sitting in the Salt Lake Stadium where we had like three races or four races or whatever. And consistently, I would just see their bike get up and plane very well on the whoops, where ours were kind of doing this a little bit more. But then it would fall apart. The front end would fall apart in other sections. My feeling is either working through him or working with the Japanese, I'm not sure, they figured out something where they got that front end to calm down a little bit and work for him. But what I see is he's able to stand up everywhere. He doesn't need to sit down in the corners necessarily. And I think that's confidence for sure. But the setting seems to meld more with him than it did with Chase. Thank you.
Because Chase stands up a lot too.
Yeah, he does. He's
the first person I saw like riding with his feet up on the whole track. But I wonder if it goes back to like what you experienced with Plessinger, where it's like I can put all my weight into that and like it's not doing this. I wonder if the feet up riding kind of warrants some similar setup on those.
Possibly, yeah. It's one of the difficulties of tuning for larger riders is they can get the ends to do whatever they want to just by pushing, putting their body in a certain place. Yeah. James Stewart is a very short inseam, and I think even he believes, there's tuners that work with him that say things about how stiff his suspension was, and I don't necessarily agree because I built it, and I didn't have this monster rock that I couldn't compress.
Yeah.
He's a little guy, and he tends to sit in the middle of the bike, and the bike works around him. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it look like the suspension isn't active, but he's actually in the golden zone, and the bike is doing this around him. I think that was a lot of the, like a lot of the perception of him riding, because he certainly is, I'd say he's easily the gnarliest rider I've ever worked with, right? Like, somebody was asking questions about it yesterday. There wasn't a day, not a single day that I worked with him, that I didn't drive back to the hotel just like, oh my God, did you see what he did?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things like for us that never achieved at that level, I wanted to be a pro, right? I woke up, you know, went to school and thank God. But to see how far and to see it every single time he puts a leg over a bike, it was just amazing. And I'm so blessed for able to see that, because seeing it right here versus in the stands, it's 100 times gnarlier. And what was crazy about him was that at his house, we would develop the Supercross bike, and it's stiff, and then he takes it on the motocross track just to check it out. And he's sending it, right? Like, just gnarly and bumps, and then we're testing moto, and then he's running it on the Supercross track. And that just takes such an amazing amount of talent and no fear, literally, that he could just...
To know that a motocross bike on a Supercross track is just going to, like, blow through and probably bounce out and be I'll just adapt. Like,
and he's a multi-million dollar athlete, right?
He's stressed.
Like, if we lose that, and I remember every single time, it's just funny. So many times where he would have an almost, that just flashes in my mind. I think that the thing with James Stewart is a couple of things. Is amazing reaction time. Just, like, unbelievable. If you play this game with him, you know what I mean? You're never going to win. Taking the coin out. They don't realize it, but they have that. The other thing that was innate with him is he always knew what his rear tire was doing. He knew as soon as it touched down. He had very few crazy revs. Like, Ricky was a big rever guy. James would apply power only when he needed it. And there's a couple of points that you probably guys are going to like. So when he went from 125 to 250, we're at Glen Helen. And a 125 is basically stick it to the stop and clutch it and shift, right? So you look at his histogram on data, and it's spending most of his time full throttle. He gets on a two-stroke. This is when we were making a transition years ago. And he's never, sorry, on a four-stroke. He's never ridden really a four-stroke. So he gets on it, and he rides it like the two-stroke, singing it, and he's not going anywhere. His lap times are going down. Three sessions later, his time was now sitting directly over the horsepower and the torque peak. He was no longer revving it, and he knew, boop, exactly where those peaks were. He found them. He doesn't know any of this. And I remember explaining it to him, and he's like, what are you talking about? Because he has no clue how, like, a bike truly, truly worked at that time. But it was so amazing to see. And then he was hauling the mail on that thing, and I was just blown away. In, like, a matter of an hour and change, right? Totally turns his riding style around.
That's natural ability.
Absolutely.
There's no, like, they talk so much about that, and I'm like, no, that there's natural ability.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like a mountain bike racer, you know, literally you see some kid that's, like, your age or younger do something, and you're like, I have to do that? Like
you didn't learn
racing.
That.
Like, I'm racing them. I have to do that? Like,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Same thing. I better go to school.
Totally. The other rad about him is the Supercross track in Southern California, the Cowie track. It's right off the 15 freeway. So we'd work there from September till, like I said, the end of November, heavy development. And James would come later, so we sort of work through the stuff. He's obviously the top dog, so he can kind of do what he wants. So he'd show up after the pro circuit team, and like Michael Byrne, for example, his partner, would be riding that track for like a couple months, and we'd be logging the fastest lap time, yada, yada, yada. He shows up, and it's always a big day when he shows up, and he rides around the outside of the track, eyeballs a little bit, and then whoop, here it goes, 2 seconds.
Wow.
And they're talking like they've been shaving tenths for weeks now, right? We're getting to some plateau of lap time.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it's actually this way.
Just
and
then, getting us up here.
And then James just goes, boof, and like pulls a quad out. He's tripling this. He's, what? That's what I mean. And I'm so glad that I wasn't one of the people that was on his team, because what does that do?
Mm-hmm.
Months you've been working on this thing, and it didn't even occur to you to go four out of the corner, but he did it on his second lap. Wow. And that was just, yeah.
That's crazy.
And that's what those stories over and over and over again, just amazing things.
Man, this is quickly turning into a Vital MX podcast.
Yeah, you're shifting gears now.
Wow, but it's so good. It's so good. Fine. One last one. James is the like pinnacle Supercross, motocross racer. Do you think Jet's going to get close to that?
Yeah, I think. I mean, he's got a way to go to catch McGrath. James, unfortunately, didn't win as much as we hoped. Everybody. I mean, he was faster on a 125 at Southwick than Ricky was on a 450. He beat his lap times. And who would ever believe that he wasn't going to be able to just dominate in the 250s, right?
That's a good point.
And he got into the 250s. Part of that is he's on a 250. Everyone else is on a 450. He had to live through that. Mm-hmm. And he crashed his brains out sending it. One of them was Binghamton trying to catch Ricky down a hill. He had to. If he's going to win, he has to send it. And he lost control and crashed. And it was impossible. And you look at the torque curve of a 250 versus a 450. A 450 just makes the same torque all the way across the rev range. And the 250 is really spiky. I think that hurt him, to be honest. Hurt his confidence. And that impact, I don't think, ever changed moving forward. Then he got caught by the W, whatever, and got sidelined for...
Oh, yeah.
Which is like Olympic rules or whatever. And these guys' careers are only this. Now the system's changed. But I think those two things really stood in the way of him being the next legend. But I think if Jet stays healthy... If he finds a team and stays with them because they can give him what he wants, I think he could probably pull it off. He's certainly showing the signs of it, but so did James, and you just never know. Makes a bad team choice, goes to a team that doesn't, they're always going to pay him more. That's not going to be the problem, but is that team going to give you what you want? And that's really I'm going to call it a problem because I worked in this business enough. Some teams just don't listen to their riders, don't believe in them. Some do, and you really don't know when you're meeting a team for the first time who they're truly going to be.
Yeah.
And I think those teams that drive setting, Eli left one of them, right? Now he's with the Yamaha, he was with Cowie. And some of those rumors about them holding to a certain way, I have personal experience with him, fought for the riders, and I have to agree. I don't know what it is now, but when I was there, I definitely had lots of words for management for predefining what this megastar on a dirt bike should be riding when nobody really understands how he does it. And that's what I tell James, I don't know how to do that. You need to tell me what you need to do that, because I have no inkling of it. Mm-hmm. And before I started at Cowie, I was at Yamaha, and James had shown up to the Supercross track for the first time when he was a kid, and he had no idea how to go through the whoops. So he went in wide open. You don't go in wide open, by the way. And he crashed, did it again, crashed, did it again, crashed, and then he couldn't ride anymore. Came to the shop all beat up. This is a story from J-Bone, actually. Jeremy Albert told me this. And then... the next day he shows up, dialed. Nobody knows what happened overnight, but he figured it out in a day. And I wouldn't go near the whoops for a month, right? Because if you go into them wide open, it's just...
Yeah, it's game over.
Into them at that point.
Yeah, it's like you go in, you release throttle as soon as you get in until the bike stabilizes, and then you apply throttle again, and it's that moment in the beginning of the whoops where the work we're doing here applies in moto. You need the damping to be quick. You need no lag in the system. It needs to go immediately. And the more lag you have in the damper, the longer it takes them to get settled before they can apply throttle. And that's really, that first initial opening in the whoops is indicative of how the bike is set up.
Wow.
And you can identify its deficiencies pretty easy. Because I've been on the negative side, right, where I'm falling apart and other bikes have it dialed. But that's where the Honda shined.
Yeah.
It got in and planed out really easily. Its issue existed in the front end, going all the way back to the Chadapult. If you look at Chad at Millville, he's in a right-hand turn. The front tire is lightly loaded, and it goes into resonance, basically. And then he flies off the side of the jump and lands right next to Ryo Okuda, who ended up being the suspension guy at RCH. So him telling the story.
He thought, yeah, I can't imagine.
He's got a unique point of view.
Yeah, he's standing right at the base of that transition, right? He thought Chad was going to land on the dirt. And if I remember correctly, there was like, do I catch him? No way, right? Like,
break the ball.
Yeah, he's going to crush you.
That's interesting, though, like thinking about the whoops even, because you guys talked a lot about like increasing the damping speed on a mountain bike. It's like you're hinging stuff like that on the brakes pretty heavy,
exactly.
It seems. And the bike's going to sit the same way as if you let off in the whoops. And from there, that's where you're like what you're aiming to control. So that's a really cool kind of way to connect like what you've come here with, like, this is my world, like, and it's not that different for these like specific things, and you can make a big improvement there. And like, what's better than having more confidence through braking bumps into a turn, you know, than the feeling of like you have to wait for it to kind of settle and then you come off the brakes? Like,
it shows up on the stopwatch so obviously. And I think the thing that even Fox, because bringing me on was, I don't want to call it an experiment, but nobody really knew, right? Like, I had shown success in PVG on that side. I'd given some pointers on what to tune here, but they were very resistant. And I think it's just that familiar, what you know, what people do, the entire industry is doing this. How could we possibly be wrong? Or how could we improve it? And then I'm coming in from
Suzuki, Kawasaki, and Honda. What is wrong?
Like, exactly.
Maybe just take my word for it.
And the reality is, it's exactly the same. There's no difference at all. People tell you up and, yes, you pedal. Yes, I get it. I get it. At the end of the day, when I'm listening to riders, I'm solving the same stuff I solved in moto, albeit a lot easier because there's not the pressure and all the other things that come with it, you know. But entering a corner, going over stutters, the thing that makes suspension complicated off-road is if you have a like a bunch of oscillations, right? If you make the wheel go up and down and follow everyone, that's great. You know, you can imagine your body not moving and doing this or whatever. It doesn't work in a two-wheel vehicle because there tends to be more pitch in other parts of the trail, right? But what you do is you tighten the suspension up. You make it stiffer so you don't go into the valleys. You just kiss the top.
Yeah, you just bridge the gap, kind
of. And that's smoother. But in order to get that smoother, softer feeling, your suspension needs to be stiffer. Otherwise, you're never going to get on top of the bunts. That's the contradiction, I think, right? And that's why the use your adjuster kind of go in. And what you're going to find is when you add compression, you stay up higher in the bumps. And you can go faster and faster and faster. And the bumps can get bigger and bigger and bigger. James goes in as fast as he does because he's like, I can either hit this much whoop or this much whoop. I'm going to hit this much whoop. So he goes in, you know, just gnarly fast. And the same thing that we're trying to do now is give that suspension support so that if you go into a bunch of stutters, using compression should help keep your legs extended, let's say. You hit less of the bump, so you're getting less abrupt feeling.
Maybe give you the confidence to carry a little more speed to be like, I know it's not going to get in so much.
So what you're saying is, with this new X2 damper, we too can ride like James Stewart.
Yes.
Okay.
Sick.
Wouldn't it be rad though?
It would be.
Like, how much
it was
money,
that easy?
Like, I so wanted to just like science fiction movie, right? Just be in his helmet for a lap and feel what that feels like, because it just looks.
It's a shame GoPros sucked so much back then.
Yeah. No, seriously.
It's, when they were like live streaming off of them, you're like.
Yeah, you can't see anything.
Like a tear off or something.
Yeah, totally. Or they're pointed too far down. And it's funny when the GoPro, I'm always like lifting my head, trying.
I've got the same thing with the 360 ones where, like, your view's sort of morphing sometimes, and all halfway through, I'm like, my head's turned, so I'm trying to, like, look around.
Around a corner, right? Yeah. Totally.
I have to turn a lot off, but it is nice. You can never mess up the angle. You can just, like, oh, that's what we wanted.
Well, that was great. Thank you for insights into, obviously, what we're here to talk about, but the motocross stuff was not lost. That was epic. Thank you.
No, totally. It is that. I think that mountain biking... for as technical as it sounds, right? Because we watch it, everyone talks about mountain biking. And when I reached my fingers in talking to Villopoto, he's like, ah, suspension's no good. It's not even close to a dirt bike. So we have him right now on old suspension. And when we start getting more Group X2s, I want to upgrade him and get his read. It's him, Johnny O'Mara is a question. A lot of racers say exactly what I felt when I would ride my bike. It just feels very balloony. I don't feel like I have a lot of control of my wheel. I don't know what my contact patch is doing. And so I kind of scared to leave the ground with it, to be honest. And what we're trying to do isn't to turn it into a dirt bike, but to get this feeling of confidence and control of your wheel so that people can start unlocking speed. And I think with just depending on your air spring, you're only going to be able to go so fast before you really lose control. Mm-hmm. Now that ceiling is raised, and how it showed up here when we first started doing this a couple of years ago is, God, I'm blowing my corners, and I don't know why, up here in campus. And the reason was they were going faster than they've ever ridden that trail and didn't know it. That's the key. So you don't make suspension better and all of a sudden you start riding faster. You're just going faster without really knowing it because the system's working better. That's the recipe to get these superstars to uncork it. And that's what we started seeing is, oh shit, I'm blowing my corners because usually I'm going this fast and I can slow down here. And they very quickly realized, oh, my suspension's actually working really, really well. Hmm. And since then, we've just sort of amplified that, done it more.
That's really cool. Sweet. I dig it. Well, thank you again. I appreciate it, man. That was awesome.
Absolutely.
All right. I've got Remy Govan here, professional dirt racer for the Rocky Mountain Gravity Team and longtime Fox athlete. Remy, thanks for chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you.
So you've had the unique opportunity to spend a lot of time on the previous Grip 2 damper and now the new Grip X2 damper. Why don't you just run us through how your setups change between those dampers and how you feel the performance of those dampers differs on trail?
Yeah, so got to get onto the Grip X2 damper in January, so I'd have had a bit of time. I've had a couple months to ride on it now, and it's definitely like a larger step, you know, forward than the previous kind of iterations of Grip 2 damper. We would always get like small changes throughout the years on the Grip 2, but this one is definitely like quite a big leap forward, both in the damper and then in the bushings and the lowers. So the setup has changed a little bit, just because of the increased or lack of friction, I guess, not increase, but a lack of. And then the new damper, I've gone up like 3 or 4 PSI in the fork with an unchanged air spring. And then I've started running a lot more high-speed compression. On the old Grip 2 damper, we were kind of like floating on like basically the lowest high-speed compression that you could get away with without still having some support in like the big hits. But there is definitely always a little bit of like spiking and harshness when you would add too much. It doesn't seem to be the case with this new Grip X2 damper, where you can kind of keep adding high-speed compression and you get the like that like, you know, landing support off of like a big jump or something, but it doesn't like spike through your wrists or anything like that. So like right now, I don't know what the exact range is of how many clicks are on the new Grip X2 on the high speed, but I'm running like 5 or 6 from closed. And I want to say, like, if I were to guess, there'd probably be around 15 clicks, something like that. So now going from like on the very open end on Grip 2 damper to like now like a very middle range on the Grip X2 damper.
Sweet. My next question was just about what like standout benefits there are when you're on trail, but it sounds like maybe that controlled support has been the most noticeable difference.
Yeah, I think there's two, like the controlled support for sure. A little bit less feedback in the hands, and then just the friction aspect. I think with those new bushings, like you're getting like less, I think before it was like very, it was hard to perceive that, but now getting on this new one, like when your bike is in like awkward situations where you're loading like the wheel like in a sideways way, the fork is still super free to take the hit or absorb whatever you are. Like think of like off camber route, just like off camber sections, but then you'll like hit a hole really hard. Like there's just weird things that go on in bikes where like sometimes you're like, takes you by surprise a lot more, like where you wouldn't think that that hit would like shoot through your hands, but it happens sometimes. And I would say those moments are less with this new fork just because of the like friction reduction.
What about like on the volume spacer side? Has that changed at all? Do you generally lean towards more or less on that?
I feel like I'm pretty standard on volume spacers. Like I run 2. So I think like for my weight, the pressure that I run, like I run 107 or 108 PSI. It seems pretty standard. I've played with like 1 and 3, but I always seem to gravitate back to 2.
Feels normal. Yeah. And you went up what, like 5 PSI, 10 PSI or?
Like around 5 PSI, yeah. It was like around like 104 and now I'm 108, 109, yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Did you just do kind of the normal like additional rebound to match that, or did you find like you could almost stay in the same spot with rebound and benefit from the higher pressure still?
Yeah, I think that I didn't go up in rebound, or I didn't add rebound to match the added spring rate, but so I guess it's moving like theoretically a bit faster, but I didn't feel that I needed to like correct that, so yeah.
That's cool. I guess to give everyone a general idea, like what's something about your suspension setup that you're really particular about? Is there a certain like feeling you're kind of after, or?
Yeah, I think like the high speed rebound on the fork, I'm like, I really notice if I've gone too far. So like there'll be a moment where if I add like, or I take off a click, make it faster, I'll hit a compression. And instead of like coming out of that rebound in a controlled manner, I'll almost like feel like the bike comes up too fast and like kind of shoots you off the trail, almost giving the feeling of like your wheel unweighting too much. So that's usually when I know I've gone like a bit fast, and I just like I close it one click, and it usually that's like the sweet spot for me.
Corrects it. Yeah. I guess if you know them off the top of your head, can you give us what your settings are on your Group X2 damper?
Yeah. So I have 6 low speed rebound from closed, 5 high speed rebound from closed. The low speed compression changes, but usually 8 from closed is my like starting point. And then, again, high speed can change, but I think right now I'm like 6, 5 to 7, around there from close. So, yeah, it's wandering, like, you know, it always does wander a little bit, especially on the compression side. The rebound, I feel like I'm, like, pretty locked in on.
You match the air pressure.
Yeah.
But you're riding somewhere new all the time, so
compression's
bound to change.
Yeah.
And have you experimented with going like much deeper into the compression? Has that just become kind of like unsettled feeling, or does it kind of just beat up your hands? I mean, you mentioned the rebound gets kind of unsettled if you go too fast, but have you just not felt the need to really go too deep into compression?
I feel like it definitely becomes like just in the hands more. Like you just start to feel like instead of the fork absorbing the bump, it's kind of like, I don't know, shooting through your body a bit more, and usually that's when I'll like back it off. So I think like there's a fine line in enduro where you want that compression to like absorb the hit, but you also need to like find a setting that doesn't tire you out over like 6, 8, 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And when you start adding too much compression, like you can hit holes faster, but when you start going slower because you're tired, that usually ends up being like counter benefit. So
yeah, like how long can you realistically do that for?
Exactly. Like your hands are only so strong, and eventually like you're going to start backing off because your grip strength is gone.
So you kind of achieve it more with air pressure, it sounds like, if you're looking for support.
It's always like ongoing like learning experience to figure out like where that setting lives. But I don't know. Yeah. For me, like, sometimes you overshoot, right? Because in practice, you stop a lot, so you're usually a lot more fresh, and like you can hit things farther down the track faster. And then you get to the race run, and you're like, oh, like I'm at this, you know, 3/4 of the way down the track, and you're like, I can barely hold on now. So it's like you always have to like kind of remind yourself that it's not going to be the same when you practice versus when you race, and like your setting kind of has to like
reflect that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Cool. Well, I think that's set up.
I think that's all the questions we got. Appreciate all the insight, and look forward to watching a race this year.
Yeah. Thank you guys. Cool.
Knox.
That was sweet.
Easy.